Oh, hi. This is Cindy Howes from Basic Folk, and here's what's happening on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. Only Vans, a Texas country music pod with rock star host Bree Bagwell, recently welcomed Matt Hillier.
You sang a song nobody had ever heard, and you kept going, come on, everybody, sing it with me.
You know the words.
You know the words. It was the best.
On Basic Folk, honest conversations with folk musicians, myself and co-host Lizzie Noh recently featured John Moreland.
Some of the lyrics are like, you seem to know some things you must have overheard. It sounds like it's talking about a lover. A couple minutes into the song, he's talking about a smartphone, and it just creeped me out so hard that I got a flip phone too.
Oh, wow. And finally, the String Dusters' Travis Book is hosting the Travis Book Happy Hour, live music and conversation from guests like Trey Hensley.
Just listening to Earl Scruggs play the banjo or play the guitar, you always knew it was him. There was always those people that played, and you immediately, within a few seconds of hearing their instrument, knew it was them.
Hear it all and more on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts. Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. I'm your host, Cindy Howes. Hi, and thanks for finding Basic Folk today. Before we get into our guest, Matt the Electrician. Nice guy, Matt the Electrician. I want to talk about ways we can keep in touch. The most best way, right? That's how you say it. The best way to stay in touch with Basic Folk is to sign up for our monthly newsletter. It's a once-a-month email that updates you about what's going on with your favorite little folk podcast. You can sign up for it at the link in the show notes, or you can check out basicfolk.com. You can follow us on social media. We are at Basic Folk on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and Facebook. Put up videos and posts about what's going on with the podcast on Instagram. And I might start posting these on TikTok, too. I started these, like, Friday things posts where I talk about some things that I really like. I just started doing them, but I've talked about like some candles that I like and books, music, perfumes. I don't know, just stuff that I like. Very like basic activity to do, but I'm trying it out. All right, you can find my Instagram at Basic Folk Pod. There is a link in the show notes to social media as well. Okay, let's get into this. The world of Austin's Matt the Electrician is quirky and sincere. He's known for his work ethic and vibrant presence in the Austin, Texas music scene. Before music was full-time, Matt worked as an actual electrician in between folk music gigs and open mics. He found people were drawn to his skills in the trade, so he decided to make it part of his musical moniker. After releasing 11 studio albums and a couple of live records, the name remains, even though he has not been a professional electrician for a long time. In this episode, Matt discusses his new album release, The Ocean Knock Me Down, and shares insights into his songwriting process and the unique creative writing techniques that keep his music fresh. We learn about his experiences with the independent music community, performing live, and the joys of music discovery in the 90s through alternative music magazines like Puncture Magazine. Matt also opens up about the evolving landscape of music marketing strategies, reflecting on his journey from traditional methods to the more creative approach he employs today. For instance, this is pretty funny, Matt's been conducting fake interviews on his social media between himself and Spotify, Facebook, Rolling Stone. These interviews are hilarious. He also reminisces about the excitement of finding new music back in the day and talks about his favorite snacks like carnitas tacos and the benefits of black coffee that I can agree with. That coffee clearly fuels his creativity. Really enjoyed talking to Matt the Electrician. We're going to check out a song from his new record. This is On the Seafloor, and then we'll get to our conversation with Matt the Electrician on Basic Folk.
Mm-hmm.
scared, of course I am. I read the same things that you read to me. Go softly into bed, to sleep, to dream without conclusions. I can't decide what to wear. What's going on with my hair? You understand me. I beg you to demand of me and stay here forevermore on the seafloor.
Matt the Electrician, welcome to Basic Folk.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Let's get into it. Okay. You were born in San Francisco, California, and you spent your formative years in Northern California and Southern Oregon. You came from a family with a blue-collar background, so it's safe to say your dad was a union carpenter, your mom was a seamstress.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think their work ethic and the way they approach their work has impacted the way that you work?
That's a great question. I really do think... that it definitely instilled in me at an early age the idea that it was pretty normal to work hard for something that you wanted. I think there's another part of me that is naturally lazier than that, but I think there was that the work ethic, the ethic itself was buried pretty deep down in me, and so. There have been times in my life where I feel myself kind of slowing down or like I don't want to push this hard for something. And then I get like a little jolt and it's like, you have to actually lean in and kind of work hard if you want something to happen.
Hmm. Your parents also really loved music. A couple of different artists that they played around the house, John Denver, Taj Mahal, Pete Seeger, Paul Simon, they played music as well and would hold living room jams with their friends where like everybody would play and sing along. It sounds so fun. How do you reflect that music? How do you reflect on that musical environment that your parents created when you were growing up? And where do you see that influence in your musicality?
Oh, I mean, I think it was a fantastic way to introduce kids to music. It was kind of sideways. It wasn't, we were never kind of forced to take lessons if we didn't want to, but if we expressed interest in something, we were kind of offered the tools to figure it out. And if we did express interest in taking lessons or taking it further and more formally, they were usually pretty game to do that as well. But I think just having so many instruments in the house and I think the idea growing up with the idea that music was also social, it was something that you did. It wasn't just something that you paid money to go out and see, whether it was a classical music recital or a band at a bar. It was this idea that it was part of the social fabric. Anytime there was a party, anytime there was a gathering, it was going to kind of end up with guitars getting pulled out and people singing songs that they loved. And I think also just that idea that you didn't have to be a professional to sit around and sing songs with your friends. And I know that that's definitely influenced at least, I think, the way that I have always tried to approach music, which is that it should be fun. It should be something that is fun and something that you're sharing.
Hmm. Yeah. So speaking of that, from what I gather, you're like a pretty hopeful, positive, fun and funny person and have been that way since you were a kid. So a friend said about you, I've never seen Matt lose it. I think it's because he turns to humor every time he experiences something frustrating and somehow manages to do it with great warmth and empathy, which is great. But I wanted to talk about the other side of that coin, which is like, maybe you're using humor to deflect conflict. But like, how do you see it? How do you use humor and where do you think that comes from?
Sure. I get this a lot from friends and also in interviews. And of course my wife and my kids, think it's hilarious because they see the other, the other side of me, which is, I think the other side of everybody. We all have some dark and some light. And in my household, I am definitely, I'm grumpy dad. My main nickname is safety guy, which is not necessarily grumpy, but I'm the one who's constantly reminding people to leave the knife handle, back on the counter. And so there's a lot of nitpicking that my family gets from me that is not the the easygoing, funny, warm, singer songwriter.
You're just trying to help them survive. That's all.
That's how I look at it. Nobody seems to appreciate it.
Have you heard of negative bias? I love bringing this up on this podcast. Negative bias is like,
I'm sure I have.
It's like an old caveman thing where it's like, well, I don't want to be killed by a saber-toothed tiger. So I think I'll stay home and stay in the cave. Not being risky or anything. So that sounds like safety guy.
Sure. Yeah, there's a bit of that. It's definitely, I think I am more adventurous in my professional life. Like if I'm by myself, I don't mind traveling, to different parts of the world and trying strange foods and all of that. And I think when my kids are around me or if I'm with my family, I'm more worried that everybody else is going to get hurt somehow. A little more to that, but
just no regard for personal safety.
Yeah, I've got 40 years of skateboarding to back up that assertion. But the humor to cover darkness thing is very interesting to me because I know that I've done that throughout my life at various times. And I think as I get older, I'm always trying to get closer to what I believe is a truer balance between utilizing humor and maybe even to get out of dark situations, but trying to do it in a very intentional and mindful way, so as not to just make jokes to avoid talking about something or to avoid dealing with something.
Yeah. I get that. I get that so hard. And you're right. Like, I feel like as somebody who also uses humor to deflect, like as I've gotten older, it's like finessed a lot more than it used to.
Well, I think when I was a kid, I loved Chevy Chase. And I think there was kind of a dumbness and a cockiness to his comedy. And as a young boy, that seemed really appealing. And as I get older, he is less and less funny to me, like even his older movies that I loved so much. And I find myself drawn, I don't know, just to different, more thoughtful, types of comedy, whether that's, I don't know, Michael Ian Black or suddenly I've forgotten all the names of all the comedians I've ever heard of.
That's a good one, though. Michael Ian Black, for sure.
He's fantastic. He's aged well. In terms of kind of the way he seems to approach the world. I don't know if you read his Substack, but he's a really bright, insightful, interesting guy.
I have not read his Substack. Is he in that Wet American Summer crew?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is at the core of my favorite things in the world is that group, which was Stella, which was Michael Ian Black, Michael Showalter, and David Wayne. And they were from The State that was on MTV in the
80s. Yeah. Okay.
And Stella, yeah, and their stuff is more kind of shock humor and finding a trope that might not be funny, but just pushing it and pushing it and pushing it until I guess it's funny or it's just mean or it's awful or, who knows? Yeah.
Sounds exhausting, but also hilarious. Okay, this is a little bit of a setup. So stick with me here, Matt.
Sure.
Trumpet was your first foray into music, but it was eventually abandoned for the guitar. You started writing songs when you were 15, and you said, my creative writing teacher at the time, Ms. Merrill, let me write a song in lieu of a poetry assignment. Great. I love that. Then you started playing a weekly gig at your local coffee house, Bittersweet Coffee, which is perfect. This also happened to be like the only gig in a very small town. And at this gig, there were no real rules or guidance, which I'd love to hear more about what it was like to have that gig, to learn how to perform, to learn how to be a musician without any supervision.
Wow. Yeah. I just feel endlessly kind of grateful and fortunate that I had the weird little niche that I did in this little teeny town. And the people that owned the coffee shop, Bittersweet, there was a woman named Minta, and she had a boyfriend named Bobby Romero. And Bobby would tell me stories like he grew up with Los Lobos guys, like in East LA. So he had all, I don't know if any of it was true, but he would tell me, regale me with all these stories of growing up with the Los Lobos guys. And Bobby had a Friday night gig at Bittersweet because he was dating Minta, who owned the place. And
he had an in.
He did. And so he let me come and open up for him, I think. And I knew like two or three songs. I really didn't know that much. But he let me open up for him, and I knew a couple covers, and I had written one or two songs. And after that gig, Minta said, well, you know what? Sunday's just, there's nothing going on. There's nobody here. You can totally play on Sundays. And so I started doing this Sunday show, and Minta, I don't know what happened to her, but she kind of disappeared. There was a co-owner, this old guy named Gene, and Gene would show up and unlock the doors for us on Sunday. And he was kind of this grumpy old man, but he was very kind. And he would give us free sandwiches and free coffee to anyone who played. And then all of our friends and sometimes our parents and relatives would come down. And it was kind of a Matt and Friends show. It was under my name, but I would invite, I had several other friends in high school that were writing songs and singing. I would invite them. My brother played the saxophone and would sing. And so he'd come down. My aunt was a piano player, and she ran karaoke nights up in the Bay Area. Like, she had her own karaoke machine. She would go from like bar to bar. And so she would come down and play. And we had friends in the orchestra that would come down and do like a string quartet. I mean, it was a total variety show. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think growing up with things like the Gong Show on TV, and like and even like the Smothers Brothers show or Laugh-In or something.
Yeah.
That felt totally normal to me. This idea that, oh, well, you gotta, you know, it's like the Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland thing. Like, we got a barn, we got people, we got costumes, let's put on a show. And so we would just do that every week. And Gene just kept letting us in. And I think in retrospect, we didn't really know at the time, but I think Minta had disappeared. I don't think Gene had paid rent in a while. And the place was just kind of open, but it got foreclosed on or shut down completely, like maybe a year after we started doing this. And Gene just disappeared. We never saw Gene again.
Wow.
And the door was just locked one Sunday, and that was it.
Wow.
So it really was this magical portal where we got to do whatever we wanted in this space.
You should do a true crime podcast about this coffee shop.
I know. Both Minta and Gene. I have no idea to this day whatever happened to them.
Wow. So it's cool to hear about all your friends and family members that would come down and perform for Matt and friends. What did that experience teach you about building musical community and collaboration?
I mean, it definitely carried through to what I do in Austin, even to this day. But, you know, there's a little bit to the more people that come, they're going to bring their friends and their family. And so it creates more of an audience. And then it also, I think in general, collaboration has always been something that's been really interesting to me. And
yeah.
And it sounds funny to say as somebody who primarily plays solo acoustic. But I've had bands over the years, and I have musicians that come and go and play with me. And I just think that that is, it's just like when I was a kid and music feeling like a social thing, is that that's what makes it fun. Like that's what, which is to say, like I'm not adverse to going to see somebody where you sit down and you hyper-focus on the thoughts or the feelings or the lyrics or the sadness of the melody. But left to my own devices, I kind of prefer a circus.
Okay, so you were listening to a bunch of great folk music growing up, but it also sounds like you spent your teen years immersed in hardcore and metal. What was that juxtaposition like for you, and how do you still feel metal?
How do I still feel metal? We went to see a jazz show the other night, and a bunch of guys that I'm friends with, and on the way home, we were all talking about Metallica. I still listen to my favorite metal records I'm getting older, and all the words that I want that used to be like right in my brain have decided to flit off into the atmosphere.
It will also, it's just the day, because that was also happening to me earlier.
Oh yeah.
Times.
Okay.
I can't tell you how many times when writing these interview questions, I would go to thesaurus.com.
Yeah.
Try to figure it out.
I love music. I know every musician I know says that, but like, I think I feel most days like I'm a bigger music fan than I am a professional musician.
Hmm.
I get so geeked out listening to all sorts of styles of music. And when I was a kid, there was a lot of folk music around, and I definitely, specifically kind of vibed with the kind of Pete Seeger, Arlo Guthrie live records.
Mm-hmm.
Just this idea that they could be funny and tell stories and then have these songs that were sometimes like really intense and deep. I liked that juxtaposition.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of kind of presenting more of an arc of all the different colors in the fabric as opposed to kind of one sensation. And when I was in middle school and high school, it was the 80s and glam metal, hair metal was kind of the big thing. And so I got into all those bands.
Pre-Nevermind.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, this was like the Scorpions and Rat and early Metallica. And I was skateboarding a lot. And so that's also just kind of the music of skateboarding was stuff that was fast and loud. It's fun to skateboard too. It's not really, you don't go out skateboarding to Gordon Lightfoot. It doesn't really.
No.
it's nothing, you know, wrong with Gordon Lightfoot. Like I would come home and listen to Gordon Lightfoot. But when we were skating, and we were just talking the other night about, I remember so viscerally when Master of Puppets came out, because I didn't know about Metallica yet. That was my intro record.
Mm.
And we were skating at this underground parking garage, and we had dragged a ramp down there. And there was this metal kid who didn't skate, who would always hang out with us, named Ian. He was like friends with one of the skaters, and he always had a boombox, and he played this cassette tape of Master of Puppets. And I just remember it was one of those moments where you hear something that you've never heard before, where everything kind of changes in the way that you take in music. I had listened to metal, but this was like, it was just deeper. It was chunkier. It was like the heaviest thing I had heard to that point. And then through that, then you go and find stuff, you find Death Angel or Napalm Death or whatever the thing that's even darker and even heavier and even more intense. But they were kind of my intro into that world. But one of the bands that I listened to around that time, that was not really, I don't know what they would self-identify as, but they were kind of in the punk world and kind of in the metal world. And it was the Misfits, when Glenn Danzig was in the band. And they were kind of, some of the same guys were in Samhain and then later in Danzig's solo stuff. But the Misfits were like heavy and loud and kind of punky, but their songs and their melodies, I just remember listening and thinking, this is like the Beatles or like Michael Penn or REM or so, like the melodies were very pop and with these great hooks, but it was all shrouded in this like, rah, rah, rah. And I think that was another kind of pivotal moment for me, kind of realizing like, oh, okay, all of this can kind of be the same. You can take out pieces and put stuff back in and rearrange it how you want, but like, you don't have to just be one thing.
Right. Oh, that's cool. I didn't realize. All right. First of all, I love what you just said, and my follow-up question is kind of lame, but I didn't realize you were such a skater. Do you still skate?
I do. I am almost 52, so I skate much more carefully.
Cool. Yeah. You have two kids, right? Do they skate as well?
No, my son started to for a little while when he was a teenager, but they're both adults now and neither of them, strangely, neither of them really skate and neither of them really play music.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, listen, getting into music and skating were such a late 80s, 90s thing. Past the 90s, it's hard to get into either of those things.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a severe left turn. You married your high school sweetheart, did some construction work, carpentry, and of course, electrical work. You decided to move to Austin, Texas. So what did you know of the tradition of Texas songwriters like the Guy Clark, Nancy Griffith, Steve Earle, Jerry Jeff Walker world? And how do you relate to that tradition?
I knew less than zero about any of those people. I didn't know that any of those people existed. And I arrived in town at the open mics very much surrounded by people that had like, you know, come on a pilgrimage.
Right. It's like a reverence, you know, the Kerrville Folk Festival and all that.
Yeah. I had not heard of any of it. Not Kerrville, not
cool.
None of it.
Cool,
yeah.
Man. Welcome to town.
Yeah. It really was kind of, I was thinking about this the other day that, you know, for those of us that are lucky enough to get a little wiggle room at that age, when you're like 21, 22, 23, and if you've finished college and you haven't quite found a job yet, you haven't settled down, that freedom that you have in those couple of years that I don't think you really appreciate as it's happening. It just feels tenuous and terrifying mostly. But that idea that you can kind of go anywhere and do anything and start over and be anybody. And my parents moved around a lot when I was a kid. And so I had a little sneak peek into, oh, this can be amazing. Like I lived in a town where I went to junior high and some elementary school that I hated. And I was ridiculed. I was beat up. I was just bullied. It was a really terrible time in my life. And it was middle school, which is terrible for everyone. But we moved to this new town in high school and I got to totally reinvent myself. And it was so, it was such a big deal to me at that point in my life that I think years later when I was in my 20 whatevers, a lot of stuff had kind of fallen apart. My wife, then girlfriend, and I had broken up for a little while and that was not very good. And I was drinking a lot and there was just a lot of bad stuff. And I thought, I need to go somewhere completely new, because all my friends on the West Coast would go to Seattle or Portland or San Francisco or LA. And I wanted to go somewhere. And there was this band that I loved in the late 80s called Poi Dog Pondering. And they were Hell one yeah. of my favorite, one of my favorite bands ever. And just, you know, an interesting band, like hard to pin down exactly what they are or what they sound like. And there were like 10 or 12 people in the band and just fun and a lot of instruments and weird. And I had bought this cassette tape that was like for promo use only for radio people to listen to, like a little a little bio. It had like snippets of the songs, and in between the songs, Frank Orrell, the lead singer, would talk.
Weird.
Yeah. And it was, they were on Warner Brothers, I think. And so like Warner had sent those out to, you know, radio people or press people. Right. And I found it used in a record store. And I listened to it, and the guy, he talks about Austin. And I think sometimes when you talk about this kind of stuff these days, it's hard to remember that like there was nowhere to read about this kind of thing. Like there was no internet to look up like, where's my favorite band from? Or,
right.
You know? Yeah. There's no way that you would have known that. It's not like Frank Orrell was getting interviewed on Johnny Carson.
Right.
And so he was talking about Austin, and I thought, well, this band lives in Austin and they're weird and funny. So I'm just going to move to Austin, because if they did all right there, then maybe I will. And I was living up near Portland a couple months before I moved to Austin, and Poi Dog played, and I went out and saw him, and I went up to Frank after the show and I said, hey, I'm moving to Austin. And he goes, oh, it's a great town. We just moved to Chicago, but enjoy it. Have fun. And I was like, great. But you know, I'd already decided. And so I loaded everything into my car and drove down there. But it was funny. I would tell people that, and people go, you moved here for Poi Dog?
Yeah.
Like not towns? Like that was just a very strange thing.
Is Poi Dog pondering the band that had the album called, or maybe the song called Mouth Noises or something about the mouth? Yeah. I thought that maybe wasn't it.
I don't, not that I know of, but I'm super familiar with their first three, maybe four records. And then after that, I don't know.
Okay. Hold on. Let me like, I used to work at a AAA radio station in Pittsburgh.
It's my mom's hometown.
Oh, for real? Cool. Yeah. Let's look this up, because they had Poi Dog pondering in their collection. Let me see if I recognize any of these. I wonder if Spotify's thing is correct.
Their first big hit was Living with the Dreaming Body.
Okay.
And then
I like associate Poi Dog pondering with like weird, like Laurie Anderson. Or maybe this is it. Uli Lalu.
Uli Lalu. Yeah. They had Frank, the lead singer, was from Hawaii. And there was definitely like that thing that existed in the 80s and 90s, especially, that was world beat. Right. And so it was this idea that instead of it being West African music or, you know, Nigerian music specifically, there were a lot of bands that were just popular American bands that were just bringing in conga drums or djembes or didgeridoos or whatever. And I forget, there was a band, I think from Pittsburgh, right? That was
kind of Rusted Root.
Yes, Rusted Root. Perfect example.
And on my way, still appearing in commercials.
Yeah, Rusted Root was like the Poi Dog pondering like 5 years later. Like they came out of that same school. Yeah.
I'm getting some pretty familiar vibes from their 1990 album, Wishing Like a Mountain and Thinking Like the Sea.
Yeah, that one had their only
great
like
album title.
Legitimate hit. And
which was everyone, that?
Everyone's Trying.
Everyone's Trying. Okay.
Yeah, it's a great song. But the first record, the one before that record, is kind of the... at least in my humble opinion, is the
cool
is the really amazing one. But and then it's funny, over the years I've gotten to know most of the guys that are in the band, that a lot of them still live here in Austin.
Cool.
Yeah.
So now let's talk about how The Electrician came about. You hosted a weekly open mic. Is this correct? The weekly open mic at the beloved and now defunct Flipnotics coffee space?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was one of my favorite places of all time.
So you were doing that in 1996 before any records came out. So you would come right from your electrical job covered in sweat and grime from the day's work. And so like to explain the state of yourself, you'd say, hi, I'm Matt. I'm an electrician. And then it just like became Matt the Electrician. So for you, like the juxtaposition, because of the family that you came from, the juxtaposition was normal. Like the way that your family carried on was that if you wanted to make art, you also had to work a day job.
So that was normal for you then, but how do you reflect on that juggling act now, 20 years removed?
Well, you know, I think in the independent side of the music business these days, it's even more of an imperative because there's just so many fewer financial streams available to artists. You know, I was super lucky myself and everyone my age that did this and drove around in cars, you know, and that includes the Ani DeFrancos and Peter Mulvey's of the world. We were all driving across the country with these little discs that cost a dollar to make and you could sell for $15. Mm. And like living through the compact disc era, there were so many people that were able to make a living, like a decent living, mm-hmm. playing to 40 people, you know, like yeah. you can't do that anymore. Like that's not without other streams. That's nearly impossible. And I think about that a lot, that just the, because before that, the cassette tape era and the vinyl, there were more barriers to entry for kind of independent, unknown artists. It was a, mm-hmm. it was a much tougher thing to be able to figure out how to produce merchandise to then go and sell to people. And that early days of CD Baby and the early days of all these companies that were printing CDs and offering it really cheap, and the fact that the major labels set these arguably criminal price points that we were then able to utilize because, you know, people were used to paying that. Yeah. It really was, it was a pretty remarkable time to be alive and doing this.
So when you were still working as an electrician, can you talk about like what the work days were like and like, I don't know, what kind of music you guys were listening to on the job site? Did your coworkers know you played music? What were their worlds like in relation to yours?
Well, most days I worked for a company called Lane Hart Electric, which was at the time the biggest electrical contractor in the South. And they had like shops all through the southern part of the US. And when I first started, I was an apprentice. And after a couple years, I got my journeyman's license. But we would show up at the shop at like 6:15, 6:30 in the morning. And you load up your work truck, you would get a clipboard that would show the jobs you were supposed to go to. And sometimes you were going to wire a brand new house. Sometimes you were going to trim out a house, you know, which is putting in the plugs and switches and hanging the lights. And then sometimes you were doing service work. So something doesn't work, something stopped working. Mm-hmm. And the guy that I worked with was a really good electrician. His name was Santos Garcia. And he was a really hard worker. And he was really good at his job. And that wasn't the case for a lot of the people that worked at that shop. Mm. There were a lot of miscreants and, you know, guys that were freshly released from prison. And there was a lot of just getting drunk on the job and stuff like that. And so I got really lucky to work with this guy who barely wanted to take a lunch break. But you'd get your clipboard and it would say, you're going to these three jobs. And then it would say, in at 8. And I remember my first day on the job, you know, he hands me this clipboard. He goes, go over there and ask for, you know, these spools of wire and these boxes. And so I had to go like get all the equipment out of the shop for the day. And I saw the clipboard and it said in at 8. And I said, oh, do we come back to the shop at 8 a.m.? Because this was like 6:15 in the morning. And he goes, no, 8 p.m. And I was like, what now? And that's just how it was. We would work 12 to 14 hour days,
oh my gosh.
six days a week. And then at the end of Saturday, they would usually ask, do you want to work on Sunday?
Wow.
And you could decide whether or not you wanted to come in and work on Sunday. So I was, you know, and this was also, I had just moved to Austin 2 weeks, 3 weeks prior, and it was already close to 100 degrees every day. And I was coming from Oregon where I did carpentry with my dad, where it was like 20 degrees and freezing. And I have to say it was kind of a crash course in like your body becoming adjusted to a climate, because it only took me 3 or 4 days of just feeling absolutely lousy and kind of having like cotton mouth all the time because I couldn't drink enough water and Gatorade and everything else.
Wow.
And then after that, it's like, then, you know, I would drink over a gallon of water a day plus a bunch of Gatorades. And it was like 100 degrees outside in the houses where we were wiring. It was 110, 115. And in the attic, it was like 140.
140 degrees?
Yeah, you're not supposed to apparently stay up there for more than 10 minutes or else like kind of brain cells start dying and stuff.
Jeez.
Which I didn't know till after I had spent more than 10 minutes crawling around attics. So, yeah.
Okay. Fast forward to the early O's. You would eventually leave the job right around your 2004 release to do music full time. So are you still doing music full time? Or do you have another? Okay. All right. Just check in. So as someone who had worked since they were 12 and someone who didn't grow up thinking that arts were a way to make a living, what was that transition like for you?
I think at the time I wanted to be able to focus more time on touring. And I also felt, and I think a lot of people feel this, that at a certain point you figure, man, if I could just put a little more time, a little more money, a little more whatever into what I'm doing, that would be the thing that, you know, that'll help me to achieve this imaginary goal that I've created for myself. And I was talking to a friend of mine who, of course, I am now going to completely forget his name, but he was...
Was it Peter Gabriel?
It was not Peter Gabriel.
Just trying to help. Was it Desmond Tutu?
It was not Desmond Tutu. It was not Menachem Begin. It was not James Baker. It was
Super Mario.
Check. It was a singer-songwriter from Austin who was actually on VH1 when I was in high school, and he had a hit with another guy from the UK. And he's a dear friend, and I literally
Billy Joel. Like,
no, is Darwin? It wasn't Darwin. Dyson. Darren, someday he'll listen to this and he's going to be like, what? How did you not remember my name? Anyway, he's like an Austin legend.
Okay.
And so I was opening for him at the Cactus Cafe. And I remember standing in the little green room office area after the show. And I said, man, I really want to do more music. And he goes, Matt, you got to quit your job. And I said, yeah, but that's so scary. He goes, listen. When things changed for me, when I was really able to like give it my all and good things started happening, it was because I quit my day job. And I said, really? Like, that's what you did? And he goes, yeah. And I was like, okay. And he goes, now it also culminated in a divorce and my whole life kind of fell apart. And I was like, okay, I gotcha. Darden Smith. That's who it was.
That was going to be my actual guess.
That's so funny. Yeah. So Darden was like, told me that. And so I went home. I literally went home that night and I told my wife, I was like, okay. So Darden told me I got to quit my job. He says it makes all the difference in the world and all these great things happen. And she's like, did he say anything else? I said, no, absolutely not. Anything else. But yeah, so it was, we had a 1 year old at the time and, it just seemed, my wife had kind of been unceremoniously let go from her job
Damn.
When she was pregnant because it was just that's how the world works.
Texas.
And yeah, totally. And so we both were kind of like, man, we both want to do arty things. And, you know, we had purchased a house when we were both working 80 hours a week with no kids. So we had saved up a bunch of money. And I had a little 401k and we owed very little on our house and everything was cheaper then. And so we thought, you know what, let's like take some of this money we have and we'll live our lives on credit cards. And then if we get into trouble, we'll just take out a refinance loan on our house because we, you know, our house is already worth a little bit more and we've paid it down so far. So that was literally our grand master plan.
Wow. What could go wrong?
I know. we did manage to get into some serious credit card debt like happens. But we were able to kind of leverage against our house and in the grand scheme of things, the the random luck of buying in a what ended up being a very desirable neighborhood in Austin, Texas, that was not so much at the time.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
you got it. You nailed it. Good job, guys. So the stigma of a musician having a day job is something that you have been like opposed to, you know, like you were against the idea of not being serious enough unless you like quit and focus on just music. And there's also something to the values that your parents instilled in you that like music is fun. It helps you connect with others. I keep thinking that like keeping your name as Matt the Electrician is part of it. But now that you've been doing music professionally for 20 years, how do you maintain like both of those beliefs?
Well, I mean, I've thought of changing my name several times over the years, and it just didn't make sense, I guess, because once you spend enough time kind of building up, you know, as I always say, clawing your way to the middle, you know, takes a lot of energy. And so once you get to that ladder rung at the low middle where you want to exist, it would be stupid to start over. But in terms of like the psychology of it, you know, every once in a while, I'll do an interview or people will just come up to me at a show. I had a guy come up at a show 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And he said, "Oh, I saw you play with Peter Mulvey at the Cactus." And I said, "Yeah, Peter and I did a show together." He goes, you're the electric Jim. And I just said, "Uh-huh, I am. Thank you. Thanks for coming." And I walked away. I think that there's part of that. There's part of, I've been kind of poked fun at or people misremember the name, or they'll go, "Oh, you're the Mike and the Mechanic, right?" And I'll go, yeah. There's something to that I maybe didn't even do intentionally, that it's a reminder not to take yourself too seriously, because we're making things up for a living. We're making things up and hoping that other people are interested in the things that we've made up. Like, we're not curing cancer. We're not designing rocket ships. I think it's important. I think art is important. I think it's incredibly important. But the more that we kind of know that we think it's important, I think then it can get kind of, maybe not destructive, but kind of. It can be something that if it's too precious and it's too serious, I don't know. I like the idea of being forced to not take myself too seriously. And by hanging on to that name, even though I don't practice electrical work, even though I do it at home sometimes, it's like a reminder to myself that at any moment I could go back and do that, and I might have to. But also to other people that, like, hey, we all have to do work. We all have to do this. Like, we all have to do all sorts of work that we don't necessarily want to do. You know, that's just part of being alive, I think.
I'm interested in hearing from you about writing about small things that turn into big things. What is it like for you to write about something really simple to then discover it's actually not simple at all?
I mean, I don't know. I think for me, writing is something that the more I do it and the older I get, the more I'm really coming at it sideways, or, you know, from peripheral, through peripheral vision. Like I don't think that hard about what I'm writing about almost at all anymore. Just when I'm starting, and then I'm really trying to stop myself from controlling.
You turn the editor off.
Yeah, which I don't think I did as much when I was younger, but more and more I like what comes out at the end better if I don't really edit at all, at all. You know, there's a certain point in a structure of a song. Once you get two verses and a chorus in, it's hard to stop the editor from like solving the problem that you've set out. But even that, I really do try not to focus, or to blur my focus, kind of, I guess that would be the metaphor.
So you just like blackout, write all your songs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That's cool. What I do.
Wow. Yeah. You and Bob Dylan back in the 60s.
Yeah. I think that most things are the little things. I mean, I think that if you want to sit down and write a hopeless love song, but then you know that right after you're done writing, you've got to go get the oil changed in your minivan. Isn't getting the oil changed in the minivan part of you know, the actual story of a hopeless love, like a thing that can never fully be realized? And I just think everything works like that. You know, most things are at the heart, these very small things that we have to deal with day in and day out. And it's just more fun, I think, for me to write that way.
Okay. I want to talk about your new record. It's The Ocean Knock Me Down. It's your 11th studio album. And what I want to talk about is how you are talking about this record. You are running an anti-publicity campaign for this album, which includes, I can tell there are two things to this campaign. Social media videos of you interviewing yourself in disguises, representing real or possibly fictional media outlets like Rolling Stone, Instagram, Spotify. The other part of this is garnering record reviews from fans, friends, relatives, people on the street, which I'd love to hear more about. What brought on the anti-publicity campaign and how is it going?
I think the beautiful thing about the anti-publicity campaign is that if it actually succeeds, you get no publicity. So that's fantastic. there's so many ways to win with the anti-publicity campaign. I've had publicists over the years. I've had a lot of publicists. I've had some really good publicists. I've had some criminally bad publicists, and I've had run-of-the-mill publicists that were fine. And you know, in that world, you're not paying for the publicity. You're paying for the work, right? You're paying for somebody to send emails and make phone calls, and
you're paying for someone's access.
Yeah, yeah. And there's no assurance that you're going to get not only a review, but a good review or anything. And at this point in my career, I've been doing it long enough where I had some really nice years and releases where I got a bunch of write-ups, and then you get all these write-ups and you put them in your little quote sheet and you send them off to get your gig at, you know, Passim or wherever. And Matt Smith doesn't care. He doesn't care what Pace Magazine said about you. He might give you the gig because he likes your music or because he thinks you can, you know, sell 50 tickets. But we do this, and it's not, I'm not anti-publicist, but for me, I've now done it enough and I've garnered some of these nice things, and those nice things have largely not ever specifically turned into me selling a CD or a seat to a show. I think there is the idea that cumulatively they do help you. They do help people become aware of who you are. But after the last couple records and after the pandemic, I had no interest in doing it. And I think that idea too, where my last publicist, who was very good at her job, and I liked everything she did. And I, at one point I said, You know, what I don't want is just to like get that like Rolling Stone / / country.org, whatever thing that it's not really Rolling Stone, but it's online, and like getting that is
a
kind
Rolling
of
Stone annex.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of meaningless, but it's fine. That's the deal, right? It's like I'm paying this person who knows somebody over there, and they're going to send the record there, and that person's going to cut and paste part of your bio and, you know, put it on another thing and send it back to you. And then you can screenshot it with the Rolling Stone logo, and then you can show it to your fans who already like you. And your grandma's going to go, oh my God, you got in Rolling Stone. And then that's the end. And no new people are going to come across it because nobody goes to the annex to like find new music. Not like when I was a kid, when you would subscribe to the physical Rolling Stone and you really would open it up and go, whose records are reviewed? Like, who should I check out?
Wow. What a chore.
Well,
flipping through a magazine.
One of my favorite magazines in the world was this magazine called Puncture. I don't know if you ever read Puncture.
No.
This would have been probably early 90s, but it was kind of in the model of Paste. It was a little more kind of punk rock and indie rock than Paste was.
I think by the time I got to magazines, we were all suffering the consequences of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, and it was pretty bad. I'm talking like Korn on the cover of Circus magazine. Okay.
Yeah.
So anyways, go on.
Well, Puncture was just, it was kind of a no-frills music magazine that would have a couple big articles. The songwriter version was Performing Songwriter. That magazine pretty close. The only difference was Puncture was like thicker because it would have like 25 pages of record reviews, like four reviews to a page. Yeah. All these early 90s indie rock, alt country, indie, you know, folk music, whatever, singer-songwriter stuff. And I don't know, I don't know how they did what they did. But I still have like 10 or 12 copies of that magazine. And I would sit there on a Sunday or whatever and just pore over. I bought so many records based off of reading just the review of the record in Puncture magazine. And that's just simply not a thing. And it's, you know, it's somebody's fault. It's not my fault. And it's not the people that like my music's fault. So the idea of paying somebody for access to get this review that nobody outside of the people that already like me are going to see, I thought it's going to be so much more fun for the people that already like me and for me to see a fake interview, you know, where I take my shirt off and am interviewed by a guy from Sports Illustrated about possibly being on the cover of the swimsuit issue. And so far, I've been correct. Like the people that already like me think that it's very fun and funny to watch me doing these things. And I have a blast making them. So I feel like I'm essentially covering the same ground.
Mm. And yeah, you don't have to pay thousands of dollars for a publicist.
Correct. I mean, and the fake reviews, I'm still getting into the fake reviews. And it did just occur to me last night, my wife and I were talking and I said something about my new record and she goes, who said that? And I said, I said it. And she goes, oh, you got to figure out how to quote yourself. And I said, well, I think if all goes well, that maybe early next week, Terry Gross will interview me out in the shop. So, so that's, then I can attribute it to her.
That's amazing. Oh my gosh. Okay. This has been so fun. Would you please do the lightning round?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, this is a special Matt the Electrician lightning round. Here we go.
Oh, my God.
How many metal t-shirts do you own?
Ooh, how many metal t-shirts do I own? I have two. I have a Dawkins shirt from their Back for the Attack tour in 1984. Mm-hmm. 85. And I have a Metallica t-shirt from Ride the Lightning that was given to me by Kirk Hammett, the guitar player for Metallica, backstage at the Monsters of Rock show in 1986 at Candlestick Park.
Wow. Never get rid of that one. That's a low number.
Yeah. Well,
Significant shirt.
It's possible. it's possible that I have a Misfits. It's not really metal. That's like I said,
yes,
they're more kind of
this
punk
earlier.
Rock.
Yes.
Yeah. I have a Danzig and a Misfits, so that could count as two more shirts.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. 2.5 will be. What was the first album you bought with your own money?
My mom took me to Bi-Mart in Medford, Oregon, or Ashland, Oregon, I think. And I bought two 45s. I bought Dolly Parton 9 to 5. And
great.
The B-side was Working Man. And then I bought Eddie Rabbit, I Love a Rainy Night. And I don't remember what the B-side was to that one.
Wow. Yeah. That explains everything. Here's a couple questions about snacks. What is your favorite road snack?
Oh my God. My favorite. There's so many. I love chips of any kind. Just any chip I will eat. But these days, my favorite road snack is just the salted, already shelled pistachios.
Oh, nice. Wow.
Yeah.
Blowing my mind. All right. Here's another snack question. What is your favorite Texas treat?
My favorite Texas treat is probably the same that was my favorite California treat, which is just a really good carnitas taco.
Ooh, yeah. I'm sure that's awesome where you're at.
It is.
Next question. Can you defuse a bomb?
I mean, I do have some electrical expertise, and I feel like there's usually a red wire and a black wire. And I mean, I if somebody's life depended on it, probably not, but I'd go for it.
Okay. I'm assembling my superhero team. I'll hang on to your application.
Nice.
All right, two more. What is your coffee order?
Oh, just black coffee, no sugar. No
all right.
Milk. Yeah.
Last one. What is your dream vacation?
Oh, there's so many. Well, you know, one that I've never done. I've gotten to go so many places. I tour all over the world, and I've never been to Ireland. Or I've been to Ireland, but only to Dublin. And I've always wanted to go to the west coast of Ireland and do a bicycle tour.
Yeah, and listen to Cranberry's Dreams.
Absolutely, surely.
On repeat, the whole trip. Great. And then, wait, that's it. We did it.
That was it. That was the lightning.
Yeah, that was the lightning.
All the lightning.
I was just struck by lightning for a quick second. Yeah. Matt the Electrician, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was so fun to talk to you, and congrats on the new record.
Thank you so much for having me, Cindy.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. You can find Basic Folk on the Bluegrass Situation podcast network, wherever you get podcasts. You can check us out on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app, or you can check out our website, basicfolk.com. Okay, if you enjoyed this episode, we suggest sharing it with a friend. And might I suggest your friend who is very handy and also a singer-songwriter who is very funny, who kind of actually looks like Matt the Electrician? That's right, Scott's Roger. I'm looking at you, and I'm sending you this episode. Send this episode to your friend Scott. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Thank you for listening all the way to the end. Bye.